Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, they are available on Spotify. Well, December greetings, folks, friends. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. And hopefully you've been watching some new movies, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. A little shift in format this week and next week. Next week I'm taking off because of New Year's and because of work commitments. And I'm doing a different version. I will ask for your requests in a couple weeks. The first weekend show in January is when I will review my top 10 films of 2020. And at that time, I'll ask for your favorite film of 2020. But I want to get to a couple of new films from this week. Both have something in common. Both are a slight disappointment. The big, big title, of course, this week is Wonder Woman 1984, which has just come out on streaming. And I got to watch it earlier this week. So let me premise this by saying good to see Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins back as star and director in this case. And we shouldn't forget that the first Wonder Woman film is not perfect. It's a lot of fun and very good. You just can't cast David Thewlis and expect to be shocked when there's a character turn, when there's a heel turn, I guess, in the film. This time around, it's Wonder Woman 1984, maybe an homage to the TV series that did one season in the 40s and then moved it to the 70s. This time around, she is in 1984. She's working as an archaeologist, well, the most beautiful archaeologist ever. And this time around, she has not one but two adversaries to deal with. One is a rich mogul, well, so-called rich mogul, played by Pedro Pascal, for you fans of The Mandalorian, plays a business tycoon whose finances are not what they seem. Sounds familiar. And we also have Kristen Wiig in this film, and good for Kristen Wiig to get some superhero money playing Cheetah. Although her character, unfortunately, has the same journey as Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns, as well as Uma Thurman in Batman and Robin. In fact, this film is a lot like Batman Returns. In fact, we have two adversaries. There's a Christmas scene at the end. It's not a Christmas film. I don't care. But it does have those similarities. Chris Pine is back, and I'm still not 100% on how they brought his character back, but who am I to say? There won't be a Zack Snyder cut of this, I hope. We have some low-hanging fruit with the billionaire, or so-called billionaire. Similar trajectory. And yeah, I'm citing a film that's almost 30 years old, but it's still fresh in the head. The other low-hanging fruit aspect of this is the fact that, and they get rid of it early on, fortunately, but it's still an easy cheap shot of, look how wacky the 80s were when it comes to fashion. There's actually a fashion montage with Chris Pine, ladies, and a few dudes. You're welcome. So I guess one of the complaints about the film is that there's not enough Wonder Woman, and there's some social commentary they want to get into this. There is a couple of action sequences. The one on the mandatory one that's done on a highway with trucks and fast cars, that's fun. When we get to a big climactic fistfight between our two ladies, it's not the best shot looking thing in the world, but they get to, and there's some moments where you can see it's them and not their stunt doubles. So, but that's a minor quibble. I'm just saying it's not bad. It's just a step down from the last Wonder Woman film, which was a huge, not only a huge breath of fresh air as far as female action, female superheroes, but also still the best film that DC has put out. So it is going to be a step down. There is a nice cookie in the credits, so stick around for that. But I didn't get the burst of fresh air and magic that I did with the first Wonder Woman film. So there you go. It's out there, and you can check it out. The other one is the latest film from George Clooney, Midnight Sky, which he directs and stars in. And we get not one, but two post-apocalyptic tales. Clooney plays, the world is going to hell in a handbag. Sounds familiar. And Clooney plays a lone scientist in the Arctic. Everybody else has left the post except him. And trying to do what he can to keep things going or just waiting to die, depending on your point of view. And he discovers a stowaway under his care that he has to work with. Sounds a little like Tomorrowland, although he's not nearly as grouchy in this film as in that one. The second story is we have a roving space a living community up in space, a project with the likes of Felicity Jones, David Oyelowo, Kyle Chandler, Damian Bashir, and their questions of do they return to Earth? What do they do? They try to Clooney's character tries to communicate with the roving project up in space. The film has a tone. It's been compared to Gravity, I think, as far as especially the solo George Clooney material and the fact that there's some space stuff happening. My wife said it was Gravity with All Is Lost, the Robert Redford film where he's slowly sinking a ship with his ship. There's aspects of that. There's aspects of silent running. This is a somber science fiction post-apocalyptic tale, and eventually they have to tie the two stories together, and the way they tie it together just doesn't quite do it for me. It might do it for you, but it doesn't quite do it for me. So this is a grown-up science fiction story. I've mentioned a few films, all of which were far, far better in executing the somber sci-fi story. So and All Is Lost. But The Midnight Sky is now available via Netflix. Before we get to the IFJA winners, I forgot to raise a glass for author Jean Le Carré, the great spy author who gave us The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, one of the best anti-Bond films ever from 1965, one of the best performances from Richard Burton. Of course, gave us Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, made into a miniseries and a film with Gary Oldman. I have actually the miniseries of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy on Blu-ray. It's been sitting on my desk. I just need to get to it, so I'm hoping I will get to that. Smiley's People, Little Drummer Girl, The Russia House, Perfect Spy, Constant Gardener, Tailor of Panama, The Night Manager. So, thank you for all your espionage work there. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we get to my guest, I do want to announce earlier this week on Monday, the Indiana Film Journalists Association, of which I am a member, had announced their awards for the 2020 season. And I'm not going to reveal my ballot until the first show in January, as I said earlier. But here you go. I'm proud to be a member of the IFJA. Much love to my IFJA brothers and sisters. Wish I could have been there for the meeting, but a personal matter came into the mix. But here we go. The best film for 2020 from the IFJA, its winner is Nomadland, with its runner-up Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. The other finalists, listed alphabetically, Another Round, The Assistant, The Five Bloods, First Cow, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, Minari, and The 20th Century. Our best animated feature winner was Soul with runner-up Wolfwalkers. Our best foreign language film winner was Another Round with runner-up Song Without a Flame. Best documentary was Dick Johnson is Dead with runner-up Athlete A. Best original screenplay, Eliza Hittman for Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, and runner-up Matthew Rankin for The 20th Century. Best adapted screenplay, the winner was Chloe Zhao for Nomadland, runner-up Charlie Kaufman, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Best director, Chloe Zhao, Nomadland, runner-up Regina King, One Night in Miami. Best actress, Frances McDormand for Nomadland, runner-up Jessie Buckley for I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Best supporting actress, Maria Bakalova, hope I'm saying that right, for Borat subsequent movie film, and runner-up, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering these names, Yao Yong-jung for Minari. Best actor, Delroy Lindo for The Five Bloods, runner-up Chadwick Boseman, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Best supporting actor, winner Leslie Odom Jr. for One Night in Miami, runner-up Chadwick Boseman, The Five Bloods. Best vocal motion capture performance, the winner was Jamie Foxx for Soul, runner-up was Sean Bean for Wolfwalkers. Best ensemble acting, winner was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, runner-up One Night in Miami. Best musical score, Ludwig Göransson for Tenet and Emil Mazzeri for Minari. Breakout of the year, the winner was Maria Bakalova for Borat subsequent movie film, and runner-up Andrew Patterson for The Vast of Night. And the original Vision Award, the winner was The 20th Century. Runner-up was Dick Johnson is Dead. And the Hoosier Award, the winner goes to the documentary Athlete A because of the reporters from the Indianapolis Star. So congrats to all of the winners and runners-up. Your IFJA, the Indiana Film Journalists Association 2020 Film Awards. And I won't go through my ballot next week, but I'll go through my top 10, not next week, but the first film sociology in the month of January. All right, guest time. So, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we get to my guest, actually, this is kind of the last-minute shopping portion. By the time you're listening to this, hopefully you got your shopping done. And if not, you can still buy these. But I got sent to me in the mail, courtesy of Time Life Home Video. Did not expect this, and it was a lovely surprise, and it's going to take a while to get through, but I thought I'd mention it now. But there is a multi-DVD box set of Dolly Parton. Everything from concerts to variety show episodes, interviews. It's similar to the Robin Williams package that came out last year. And anyway, I'm starting to go through it now. Now, I'm going to talk about the films of Dolly Parton, at least in the early years. And then as time goes on, I will, by the time we get to the next show, I'll have a good chunk of this collection watched, and I can give you a little more info. My daughter and I sat down and watched a couple episodes of her variety show from the 80s, and, it's a little rough. Especially in Emma's case, she's 19. You know, the gold standard for variety shows was the Carol Burnett Show, and I had to explain to her by the time Carol's show was done in the late 70s, there were several attempts in the 80s to try to have another variety show step up, and none of them ever really came close. And while there isn't a bad thing to say about Parton, I mean, well, there's a couple films, but we'll get to that. But the format is just, you know, her singing is fine. There's a couple date segments, Dolly's Date Night, one that I've already watched with Dudley Moore, another one with Bruce Willis that's really kind of cringy. And so, anyway, I'll watch a few more of those as I go on with the collection. But we did watch a full concert that happened in London in 2009. That was a little more easier to swallow, much more fun. And, you know, she gets to see her bubbly personality and the great music that goes with her career. So I want to go through her early film work because I actually saw these films in the theater, and this was kind of a big deal. Yeah, as a boy, Dolly Parton was this kind of larger-than-life figure, and and boys like, well, some boys like that. I did. But we start in 1980 with 9 to 5, which a smart move on her part because she's not carrying the film. She gets to share and get some experience screen time wise with the likes of Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dabney Coleman. And it works. I remember seeing that I was 10 when I saw this, and I thought this was one of the greatest films ever made because it was so much fun. And I also a grown-up movie that I got to experience. Her follow-up eventually, yes, she got to do a musical. She got to play Mona in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas with Burt Reynolds. She carries a lot of the vocal weight. And yes, Charles Durning and Dom DeLuise sing, and they're fine. And you have the chorus that chimes in as well. But the majority of the musical responsibility falls on her, and she does it well. And I actually like Whorehouse, and anyway, I enjoyed that. I know it got mixed results, but I still enjoyed it nonetheless. Then we get to Rhinestone, the film directed by Bob Clark, where she plays a country singer stuck in a New York honky-tonk. Yes, there was that one time, young folks, because of her in Cowboy, country western bars popped up everywhere, including New York City. So the fact that we're doing country western bar humor in 1984, which really by then it had gone away, but she's stuck in a ironclad contract with skeezy club owner Ron Liebman. They make a bet. Her body is one of the wagers over her contract that she can make anybody into a country singer, and it turns out to be a cab driver played by Sylvester Stallone. Yeah, this film got made, and it's really hard to watch and really bad. And so the idea of Sylvester Stallone singing and singing badly is entertaining for you. Here you go. I know he did the theme from Paradise Alley. That's way better than anything he did in Rhinestone. Wound up doing, and of course, the majority of her work is a lot of TV movies and also playing herself in TV movies. But she didn't do another feature film for 5 years after Rhinestone, and it turned out to be what I think is her best work. She played Truvy in Steel Magnolias. Now, this is, I use this comparison for this one example. In this film, Dolly Parton is Sean Connery. And what I mean by that is Sean Connery got a lot of given a lot of leeway, I should say, because he got to, you know, he's our favorite Scottish submarine commander in Hunt for Red October, our favorite Spaniard in Highlander, our favorite Arab in The Wind and the Lion. She's our favorite Louisiana hairdresser with an accent from Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. You know, she's the only Southerner, if I remember correctly, in the cast. You have Sally Field, Shirley MacLaine, Julia Roberts, Daryl Hannah, and Olympia Dukakis, all doing Louisiana accents, not Dolly. But we love Dolly, and it's okay. So she gets a pass on this one, just like a Sean Connery-level cinematic pass. And I think it's her best work because she is what we want from her in this. She's bubbly, she's caring, she's a spitfire of the group because she has the hairdresser, the hair salon, and she gets the bounce off really good actresses. So this was, like I said, from 1989. I remember I was in college when this came out, and this was a huge deal for the theater students to finally, especially the ladies, to finally see this film that everybody has done in community theater or high school or both. So, but yeah, and that was basically her 80s film work. After that, we get into stuff like Straight Talk, which particularly good, and she plays herself a lot in films like Miss Congeniality 2 and other things. So, but I'll talk a little more about the collection and tell you what I've watched when we come back in a couple weeks. But it is out there courtesy of Time Life Home Video, the Dolly Parton collection. It's a lot. All right. We now go to the interview section of the show. I got the chat with Richard Lertzman, the author of Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. And it's a book about the life and career of Joey Bishop and also his contribution and the impact that the Rat Pack had in their time. So here is my interview with Richard Lertzman. Richard, before the book, could you tell me your impressions of the Rat Pack or the Summit?
The Rat Pack and the Summit was kind of a major pop moment in 1960. It was the kind of an end of an era of Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and the rest. As Elvis was coming to town and rock and roll was building, the Beatles were right around the corner, and February of 1960 was their moment, was the moment for three of the biggest stars, musical stars at that time. So it also put Vegas on the map, the summit. It was used as an event to place Vegas, which was just a kind of a destination trip from Los Angeles, but it put it into the eye of the rest of the country and the rest of the world as an adult playground. And the event gave Vegas that momentum to really build upon that.
Yeah, I think at that time, I started going to Las Vegas with my family in the 70s. And before that, it was, like you said, kind of an emphasis on adult with a capital A. It was a grown-up place to go. It's a place where you dressed up. It was, you know, it was stuff that the kids were home or with somebody else, and you got to – this was apparently the origins of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
It was – at that time, it was – in 1960, it was – people from Los Angeles would spend the weekend or go down there, but people in New York had their own clubs in Chicago and Miami and Philadelphia and all the rest of the country. And when they had the spotlight in the summit in those 28 days and then the film Ocean's 11, it really changed the perception of Las Vegas.
Going with the intro of the book, you start with an introduction to Joey Bishop, and I know near the end of his life, he started a lot of conversations with, I don't want to talk about the Rat Pack. How did you get past that with this book?
You know, by the time I met Joey Bishop in the 90s, he was very bitter because for about 20-something years, he had been forgotten, and the only reason he was remembered by the time I met him was that Sammy had passed, Dean had passed, Frank was ill, and he was the last man standing. You know, Peter Lawford was also passed away. So that's all they remembered him for, and he kind of was, you know, very bitter that, you know, they didn't remember him for, he had a TV show, he had a talk show, he did other things, and he would have that kind of outer shell, like, I'm not going to talk about the Rat Pack. But in fact, this was the high point of his career. You know, he was the MC at the inauguration for John Kennedy because of Frank Sinatra. He was part of this major movement in 1960. So he had a shrine in his house. He lived outside of Newport Beach in California. And it just was everything Rat Pack. So once you got past that outer shell, he really let down his hair and he just really told us great stories about the Rat Pack.
Yeah, in reading the book, there was that kind of parallel of, or the, I guess the double-edged sword of where he didn't want to talk about it, but then when he got offers to do tell-all books, he absolutely refused because he said these were my friends.
Yeah, he was very protective of Frank Sinatra when he talked about him. Even though Frank had really cut him off and they had a breakoff point in 1963, he just was very respectful toward everybody, but, you know, he thought that he was a major part of that group. And the truth was, he was the straight man, he was there, but that he was a cog that could have been replaced by any journeyman comic, because he just played straight to three of the super talents of that era.
Mm-hmm. Going back to his early days, there's a combination of talking about being from the Bronx, but actually being from South Philly. But I know both of those locations have something in common. It was you either be funny or you learn how to fight.
You know, you learned on the street. And Joey was definitely a street kid. And he grew up in South Philly and where a lot of other some great talent came out of. And you learned, you know, if you didn't learn a trade, a lot of people turned to show business. And Joey, with a group of friends, created a group called the Bishop Brothers. And, you know, he knew how to fight. He knew, you know, how to survive on the streets. His family was poor. His dad owned a bicycle shop. And he, from there, he started at a young age and was doing clubs back in the mid-1930s. with the Bishop Brothers and then on his own.
Yeah, is it safe to say Uncle Sam broke up the Bishop Brothers?
Yeah, he had to go. He served time in the Army, and he did sort of a USO type of thing in Texas, and after that he went right back to as a single act in at a place called the El Dumpo in Cleveland in 1938, and it sounded like what it was, but the great thing for Joey was the El Dumpo had all these mob guys that became some of the leaders in Las Vegas, Mo Dalitz and Billy Weinberger, and Mickey Cohn was around in that era. And so all the people who were influential in building Las Vegas, Joey rubbed noses with, and they learned Joey was could keep his mouth shut and keep his nose clean and, you know, didn't say a word about anything, and they trusted him.
And didn't these club owners, these businessmen, get him protection from the military?
They didn't get him protection from the military, but they got him a cushy job in Texas, where Joey had just got married and came. He went down with his wife, and so Joey actually didn't serve any time during World War II in Europe or Japan, but his time was spent in Texas.
Okay. We're talking about the book, this Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. And I believe it was an article in the Chicago Sun-Times that referred to Joey as the Frown Prince of Comedy. How did he earn that title? From his approach?
His approach was very dour. He was always the little man looked down upon, you know, kind of almost a Rodney Dangerfield. He gets no respect. And he had a very acerbic, very quick wit, and so he was you know, part insult comic, worked the crowd that way, you know, part angry. He was an angry man, you know, part Rodney Dangerfield. So he had like a combination as part of his act.
But he also knew he had to look at the crowd and work the crowd to a certain degree and know which jokes would or would not cross the line, especially with club owners.
You know, he knew lines not to cross. He crossed it once with a guy named Machine Gun. He had crossed with some of the wrong people. And he learned early on, you know, what lines to cross and what lines not to, especially a lot of these clubs that were mob clubs.
Mm-hmm. How did Joey Bishop and Frank Sinatra meet?
Joey was a favorite of Abe Glasvogel at William Morris, and Abe Glasvogel slowly worked Joey through a lot of the clubs, and Joey was never the headliner. He was always the opening act, because Joey was great for singers or other comedians, because he didn't suck the air out of the room like a Don Rickles or a Buddy Hackett or somebody, you know, who would just take all the air out. So Frank had seen him appear in at the Latin Quarter in New York, and so Frank asked for Joey. And Abe Glasvogel thought he was right, and he did. It worked great with Frank, and Frank stuck with people like Pat Henry later on and Tom Dreesen, who were similar to Joey, that they were funny, they were journeymen, but they didn't attract from the main attraction, which was Frank.
I think reading this, and I think I remember seeing footage of this, and where there would be moments of Frank singing, and Joey would just find the right moment to hit him while he was singing with a slight jab. I mean, just a light enough jab that it made Frank laugh, but Frank was able to continue singing.
Yeah, and during the Rat Pack days, Joey was the straight man. But the fact was, you know, as loose and as ad-libbed as that seemed, they had writers, and one of the writers was Don Sherman, whose daughter Amy Sherman Palladino does Mrs. Maisel now. Mm-hmm. So Don Sherman was, you know, it was very scripted, very close. They knew exactly their moments and what Joey would do. Joey would roll a bar out during the Rat Pack and tell jokes, and, you know, set up Dean and set up Sammy or set up Frank, and so that's his job. His job was as the straight men to these superstars.
And reading the book, it seemed like that part of the reason for the creation of the Rat Pack was Frank not wanting to be alone?
No, I don't think at all. What Frank had 9% of the Sands Hotel, and the owners of the mob owners and a guy named Frank L. Freeman, who was the publicist, needed a super event to really push Las Vegas. And Al Freeman came up with the idea of creating an Uber event with Frank's friends that would run for a month period. And so what they came to Frank and said, what would you like to do? And he had an idea. There was an act by Louis Prima and his wife, Keely Smith, and Sam Butera. It was a very loose act in the lounge. So he thought of Dean Martin, who was appearing in Some Come Running with him. Mm-hmm. And he really wanted to appear with Dean. Sammy was just recovering from an auto accident where he lost his eye. And Frank was a big part of getting him back on his feet and getting him back to dancing and learning his balance again. So Frank said that if I bring in Dean and Sammy, and Dean had didn't want to be part of a long-term team. He already did that with Jerry Lewis, so he wanted to repeat history. So he was willing to do it for a short period. So they set up the summit, which was 28 days, two shows a night, 8 and 12 o'clock, $7 a ticket at that time. And they were very tight shows. And then Frank became closer to Peter Lawford because of his brother-in-law, because of Peter was married to Patricia Kennedy. And John Frank had an idea about pushing John Kennedy to become president. Frank had done everything else, and becoming a power broker or a president maker was a big deal to him. So Peter came to him with a script he had called Ocean's 11, and it was written by a guy named George Clayton Johnson, who at that time was a gas station attendant and later became one of the best scripters for Rod Serling, like Kick the Can, wrote Logan's Run, and it was a caper film, a heist film, and based on George Clayton Thomas's unit in the Army in the black market during World War II, and then coming back into Las Vegas. Peter couldn't sell the script for himself, so Frank took the script, took it to Jack Warner, and Jack loved it. And then when Frank said, what if I shot it at the Sands where I own 9% and they won't charge you? And Jack Warner was thrilled to death with that arrangement. So they set up 28 straight days in February of 1960, 60 years ago. So the 8 and 12 show, and then they came out into the lounge and to the casino and caused a lot of havoc and fun. And then they woke up at 6 o'clock, got their makeup on, and shot all day Ocean's 11. And it was an event that the world started watching. News cameras, and everybody focused on Las Vegas at this event. It was Woodstock, but this was this era's big event, and everybody was watching, and Vegas became the centerpiece of the world during that period.
Mm-hmm. And for Frank, it was one or two takes and no more, basically.
Frank never always felt, and this wasn't just for that, but for Frank, for all of his films, he felt fresher doing it on the first or second take. And if you didn't get it by then, Frank was out of there.
And looking back, I mean, the group, that the core group of this, I mean, it was quite the melting pot. And I know there was some rumblings off stage with patrons and management, but nothing to stop it from going forward, right?
You know, as much as we don't remember, in 1960, having Sammy Davis Jr. as part of this group was kind of a difference. Sammy faced so much adversity. Sammy went to swim in the Sands pool. They had a floating crab cap. Sammy jumped into the pool to have a swim, and one of the gamblers complained to Carl Cohn, who was the president of the Sands. They had to drain the pool and scrub it out because Sammy jumped in it. I mean, people don't realize what was going on. Sammy had a girlfriend named May Britt, who was a beautiful blonde Swede that he later married and had children with, and that caused a big uproar. So, but Frank, you know, and Dean, you know, didn't see color. They saw talent, and that's what it was. I mean, Frank appreciated talent. Dean modeled his whole career off of Harry Mills from the Mills Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they loved great talent.
And with the success of the summit and with the success of Ocean's 11, eventually Joey Bishop wound up doing some more television. Tell us what programs he started with.
Well, right after that whole period, Joey got a situation comedy on NBC from the Sheldon Leonard, Danny Thomas group, which they were producing the Andy Griffith Show and Dick Van Dyke and all these other great shows. And Joey had a show. It ran for 4 years. There were two formats. And the long format had Abby Dalton and Joe Besser and a comic named Corbett Monica. And then right after that, he became the host of Johnny Carson, of a show that was the first kind of competition for Johnny Carson. And it was a late-night show on ABC called The Joey Bishop Show, where Regis Philbin was his sidekick. And that lasted nearly 3 years. And he was replaced by Dick Cavett.
Yeah, going back to the sitcom, I know that the show ran for four seasons, but the first season was particularly rough. What happened?
First season was kind of a mix. A guy named Warren Berlinger, who had come off the stage of playing Come Blow Your Horn, played Joey's brother, and Marlo Thomas played Joey's sister, and Marlo was Danny's daughter, who also owned the series. And it was like a jumble, even though they had the best writers in the business. These are the writers who did Dick Van Dyke and Danny Thomas and Andy Griffith. It was a horrible mess. And NBC still liked Joey Bishop. So they said, give us another format. So they came back with Joey as a talk show host. And the idea was to put Abby Dalton as a next Mary Tyler Moore. So it was going to be a working comedy, sort of like Dick Van Dyke. So they took Abby Dalton, who we interviewed. It was her last interview she ever did. And Abby told us they took her, they wanted her to watch Mary Tyler Moore and bring that to the series. So she went on the stage and watched Mary and Dick rehearse and watch the shows. She came back to Sheldon Leonard, who was the producer, and he said, what did you learn? He goes, I learned that if you want me to be Mary Tyler Moore, I have to have a Dick Van Dyke. Dick can sing. Dick can dance. Dick had charisma. Joey is the Crown Prince of comedy. He has one expression, and, you know, I can't do that. And she ended up getting lines like, yes, dear, you know, I'll get that for you, dear. And it was a format that still lasted 3 years and went through more writers, some of the great writers in television, Harry Crane and Milt Josephsberg and Gary Marshall and his partner, and Bill Persky and Sam Denoff, all these great writers who created series and many series over the years. And they tried their best, but surprisingly it lasted 4 years.
Going with the talk show, I believe if I remember reading correctly, it started off strongly, partially because Carson was not on the air due to an ailment, an injury.
Yeah, and Carson, you know, was out for a little bit, so they got a little jump because Johnny had guest hosts and they didn't really use repeats, but he had guest hosts during that period. So Joey got a good start. Joey's show was done from Hollywood, from Los Angeles, and Johnny's was done from New York. So Joey had a better choice of guests at that time. And unfortunately, the bad thing on some of these shows is that a lot of them were erased. They took the videotape and reused it for other things. So only about 80 shows exist left, but there were some. It really was a great cross-section of Barbara Streisand did a show, and he had Jack Benny and Don Rickles and a lot of people who lived out in Los Angeles. And so it was always a really, the shows were great with guests. Problem with Joey is Joey again went through writers. Johnny had 12 writers. In the end, Joey had two or three writers because it was a revolving door for him. He was just very difficult to work for.
It wasn't also that Johnny Carson started to put a squeeze on guests, saying if you went on his show, you couldn't be on mine?
He did. He had a provision that, you know, if you wanted to work on our show, you can't do Joey Bishop. He later did that with Dick Cavett. And which, you know, you can't, you know, it was, he didn't want to, you know, come off as he didn't want to be the he wanted to be the gold standard of late night talk, and so he controlled that. And people wanted to be on the Tonight Show more than anything.
Mm-hmm. And what led to the big moment where Joey walked off at the beginning of his own show?
You know, Joey knew that on his tail, ABC was grooming Dick Cavett to take his place. Dick had an afternoon show on ABC and then later a primetime show at 10 o'clock. And Joey was getting angrier and angrier, and he eventually walked off his show because he knew that his days were numbered. And ABC had offered him an agreement to get out early, even though he had a longer contract. He first tried a stunt with Regis Philbin, and we interviewed Regis Philbin, and he wanted Regis to walk off the show and complain he didn't get enough to do or he was distracting. And Regis was really unhappy because he thought this would make him look like an unprofessional, like a non-professional. And Regis walked off the show and came back, and it was played up in the press. The problem for Regis, it really backfired him, because when the show was canceled, Regis really could not find work. People thought he was unprofessional for that. And he went back to Kansas City and had to restart his career as a morning talk show host.
What do you think was more uncomfortable, Joey leaving during his own show or Joey Bishop's country and western album?
I don't think there's anything more uncomfortable than Joey's country and western album and singing Hank Williams hits. So, you know, a Jew from South Philly singing Hank Williams hits is just, and with Joey's voice, which was awful, and he had all the best people. He had the Wrecking Crew work on this album. He had guys like Glenn Campbell who worked on this album. And I don't think there's much that could have helped Joey to a country western album where he's on the cover wearing cowboy gear. And that was a Twilight Zone moment for sure.
How did that happen?
You know, everybody in those days were offered a record. I mean, it didn't matter who you were. You know, William Shatner was singing songs.
Yeah.
Everybody and their brother wanted to do an album, and Joey was offered an album, and he took them up on it.
I believe, to borrow a line from Billy Crystal, I think the album went zinc.
It's a great line.
Yeah. Now, even after the cancellation of the talk show, the Joey Bishop Show, Bishop wound up being a substitute host on Carson's show after that, right?
Yeah, Bishop did over 200 Tonight shows, and Johnny really didn't hold grudges. The important thing to Johnny is, did your ratings hold up? And when Joey came in, he didn't distract from Johnny. He wasn't a threat to Johnny. No, Johnny didn't want to bring in a young host who could replace him. So Bishop was a non-threat, did great, kept the ratings up. And even when Johnny had his 10th anniversary show, which you can watch on YouTube, Joey's one of the guests, Jack Benny, Don Rickles. So, you know, Joey was in that mix. Unfortunately, it didn't pay off in other ways, as in a lot of gigs around the country and a lot of other TV shows.
Yeah, what was the later years like for Joey Bishop?
They were rough. I mean, pretty much from 1970 on, except for doing a Hollywood Squares or Match Game or a Tonight Show, Joey, who started out, you know, as a headliner after his talk show, wasn't headliner material. So people didn't show up. Joey did, you know, ended up as a warm up for Lola Falana, but Joey tried everything. I mean, he tried his own game show, which failed. He tried to do appearances in Atlantic City. He even replaced Mickey Rooney in Sugar Babies in 1981. Mickey had to take a 3-month break to make a movie, and we talked to Terry Allen Kramer, who co-produced it with Donald Trump of Sugar Babies, and she said that they thought Mickey could be the perfect replacement. The problem is Mickey was a singer, a dancer. He was an ex-burlesque player. He can do everything. Joey couldn't sing. He couldn't dance. And his acting skills were very limited. So they went from a sold-out shows to people, it was a quarter filled, and they replaced Joey with Rip Taylor. And pretty much that spelled the end of Joey's career. And so for the next 25 years, he didn't do much of anything except he lived back in near Newport Beach in Lido Isle and went on his boat and took it easy.
And if I remember reading correctly, wasn't a fan of Steven Soderbergh's reboot of Ocean's 11 nor the HBO biopic about the Rat Pack.
He was angry because he was never consulted. We interviewed Joe Mantegna, who played Dean Martin, and Bobby Slayton, who actually played Joey Bishop. And Bobby Slayton even offered to go with Joey to the opening of the HBO movie, but they had a premiere. And Joey was just angry. He was angry. He wasn't consulted. He didn't think they could be rebooted in any way. He thought there was one Rat Pack. He hated imitators. The funny thing is, you know, people like Sandy Hackett, Buddy's son, goes around the country as Joey Bishop in a Rat Pack tribute act. And there's quite a few of those that have toured the country.
And speaking of sons, I know, I believe Joey's last film was directed by his son.
Larry Bishop directed films. It was a motorcycle flick, and Larry had done a few motorcycle flicks over the years. And Larry came from a group at high school, in Beverly Hills High School, with Richard Dreyfuss and Albert Brooks and Rob Reiner, and they were all best friends. And, in fact, Larry Bishop had toured the country with Rob Reiner in a comedy act.
Wow. And eventually got his dad to do a scene in Mad Dog Time.
He did. He got it, and he also got his dad to invest in that.
Ah. So I know after Joey died, there became, with a lot of celebrities and families, there became a financial kerfuffle. Would you expand on that a bit, please?
When Joey was elderly, he was married for quite a few years to his wife, Sylvia, and he had a mistress. Her name was Nora, and Joey got dementia in the later years, and he left his money to both Nora, his mistress. He had a nice-sized estate, about $10, $12 million, and he also left it to his attorney named Ed Hook Stratton, who was also attorney for Johnny Carson and Frank Sinatra, and to the a religious group of Chabad in Newport Beach. And to this day, there's still, it's 13 years later, there's still a dispute over that money.
So, looking back on this, when did you start doing research for this book?
You know, I started in the 90s with Joey Bishop. I had known from Cleveland, Ohio, I had known people who were the guys who actually went to Las Vegas because of my family had known them, not in a business. We, as business people, we knew them as other business people in Cleveland, but they were mobsters. And so I had a chance to interview over the years Mo Dalitz and Mickey Cohn and Carl Cohn, who was president of the Sams. Carl Cohn when he was president of the Sands in 67, was there when Frank Sinatra was going to the casino and was causing all this problem. He had a group of guys around him like Jilly Rizzo, and he was drunk, and he was horribly, you know, screaming at people and screaming at dealers. Carl came down and said, Frank, behave yourself. Go back to your room, get some coffee. And Frank goes, I'll do what I want. And he took a swing at Carl, and Carl happened to be 6'5", and an ex-Gold Glove boxer, and he looked like one of the thugs from, like Mike Mazursky, like from the old films, you know, the big boxer types.
Yep.
And he took a swing at him, and Carl caught him his hand, says, Joey, don't. And then he turned his head, and Joey caught him on his jaw, and Carl, without even making one motion, just looked at him, not hurt, and hit Frank straight in the jaw. Caps flew out, and Frank flew, and that was the end of Frank at the Sands Hotel. Howard Hughes bought him out after that point.
Looking back with the Rat Pack and the Summit, I know since then, any time there's been an ensemble of celebrities that pal around and work around, it just doesn't even come close to the original product.
You know, they weren't, in reality, they weren't best buddies. It was a business relationship. These were all top entertainers who had their own careers, and they weren't, you know, Frank had Jimmy Van Heusen and Jilly Rizzo. Dean hung around with his golf buddies. Sammy was touring all over the country. But they had camaraderie because they had a respect for each talent. And when you watch them on stage, they are magnetic. It is, when you see them, even in film, in the clips from the Dismas House or from other clips of the Rat Pack, you could feel that electricity. And I don't think that it can ever be duplicated. It was Dean, Sammy, and Frank. I mean, Joey played a good cog as a straight man, and Peter Lawford was there, but it was one of a kind, and they had they exuded talent.
And at that time, no 24-hour news.
There was no 24-hour news, but they had news cameras there and newsreel cameras, and everybody saw it on the local news, or they read it in their gossip columns, and it was all over the world. Everybody watched this, and everybody wanted to go to Las Vegas and be a part of it.
Are you familiar with Mystery Science Theater 3000?
Yes, I am.
One of my favorite. They would early on in the series, there would be an invention exchange between the scientist and the host, mm-hmm. and one of my favorites was the Rat Pack chess set. Done just like the old Civil War chess set, and of course Frank was king, and the queen was kind of replaceable, and of course in the front there's Joey Bishop, Henry Silva, Norman Fell, that sort of thing. So
Hank Henry and all these great Frank had it was Ocean's 11 is a fun movie to watch. It's a little difficult in this age, it's kind of very misogynistic. So you watch it in kind of a guilty pleasure.
Yep.
But it's fun to watch because it's kind of a time capsule of Las Vegas in a different era.
Exactly. The book is called Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. Richard, what are you working on next?
I am doing the comprehensive biography of Jerry Lewis called The Clown That Cried. And if you tell the story of Jerry Lewis and his ups and downs, but his accomplishments through the years.
And what's the countdown on the release of The Day the Clown Cried?
It's going to be in summer of next year, next summer, 2021.
I'll be in touch.
That'd be great.
That is Richard Lurchman, co-author of Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. This book is published by Book Baby and available in bookstores and Amazon and all those other places. So go check that out. So you have a couple of gift ideas for the holidays or post-holidays with a book about Joey Bishop and the Rat Pack and the Dolly Parton box set. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there, whether you're going to brave the theaters or watch them at home. Hope you're watching something that's new or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. So I hope you have a great holiday no matter how you celebrate. Next week, Film Sociology will take the week off. And then the first weekend in January, I'll talk about my top films from 2020. So stay healthy, stay safe, stay sane, and be good to one another. And we'll talk soon. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!